And welcome to the Rick House. Folks, my name is Cyrus Farmer. You are watching and listening to the Stomp the Tea podcast. And folks, I got to tell you, we have a big, big show for you tonight. Let me tell you what you can expect to hear. Of course, we will be talking about episode 3 of the CNN documentary entitled Live Aid, When Rock and Roll Took on the World. Lots of things happened in episode 3. I want to take you through it, let you know my thoughts about that episode and the series. We're also going to be continuing our end of summer iconic sports theme music series. And this song that we're going to be talking about tonight is iconic. And there is a hint that I can give you. It involves football, this being the opening night of the NFL preseason with the Hall of Fame game. I'm going to be talking about an iconic football-themed music from one of the networks. So stay tuned for that. We're also going to be talking about Luka Doncic. I know by now most of you have seen the pictures of Luka and his very notable weight loss. We'll talk about that, my thoughts on that, what it could portend for not only his future, but for the future of the Lakers as well. And of course, we will be delving into everyone's favorite segment. What are you drinking tonight? So, without further ado, let's get started. Folks, I got to tell you, this Live Aid documentary on CNN has been very good. Again, is it the best documentary I've ever watched? No, but it is very good, very watchable. I've really, really been a fan of it. So, episode 3 of Live Aid, When Rock and Roll Took on the World. Folks, we left off episode 2. They covered the recording of We Are the World, and they also talked about the first portion of the Wembley leg of the Live Aid performances. Now, in episode 3, they talk about the who had not played together in 8 years when they joined the Live Aid performances at Wembley in 1985. Now, there was largely the reason they hadn't played together was because of continuing friction between Pete Townshend and Roger Daltrey. But they played together, they got it off, they pulled it off. Most people consider it a very energetic and good performance by The Who. People were happy to see them back together. The Wembley shows, the Wembley show ended with Paul McCartney, who was supposed to be this big reveal, singing Let It Be, accompanying himself on a piano. The only problem is, folks, the mic failed. When you have McCartney essentially getting ready to close the show, they give him a bad mic. I think the first half of the song, you couldn't hear over the air. You could hear it kind of, I think, if you were in the stadium in the front row, but it was the one and real only disaster that happened in either show of Live Aid, which is kind of remarkable if you think about it. They slapped this thing together in 4 weeks or less than, and they had all sorts of satellite issues to deal with to broadcast it. But if you have to pick a moment to have a gaffe, a glitch, a technical difficulty, you would probably not pick Paul McCartney singing Let It Be to a packed Wembley Stadium and have the mic not be on for the first half of the song. So it is what it is. Mistakes happen. Annoying, but it happened. Then, of course, the Wembley performances end with a sing-along of everyone who had performed earlier in the day singing along to Do They Know It's Christmas. They wrap the show and Philadelphia, your turn. So one of the things I remember about watching Live Aid was Madonna. Now, Madonna, she had a very energetic performance in Philadelphia. So the Philadelphia portion was performed at JFK Stadium, which is no longer around. JFK Stadium is essentially in South Philly, where the whole sports complex is. You know, Wells Fargo is in South Philly. The Link is in South Philly. Citizens Bank Park is in South Philly. They're all in like 2 and 3 parking lots together, essentially. And this is where JFK was as well. I don't know if they tore down JFK to build the Vet or if they tore down JFK to build Wells Fargo. I'm not sure. I don't know. But JFK no longer stands. Anyway, Madonna was there. She sings her songs. She gives a great performance. But the strange thing is that apparently Madonna was still annoyed even during her Live Aid performance, about not being asked to perform on We Are the World. Apparently, it came down to Madonna and Cyndi Lauper, you know, depending on who you listen to. And for some reason, the people putting the record together decided to go with Cyndi Lauper instead of Madonna. I don't know why you can't carve out a line or two for Madonna and Cyndi Lauper, but they went with Cyndi Lauper, who killed her portion of We Are the World. By definition, she was great. One of the most memorable parts of the song. But Madonna apparently was still a little pissed off about that. So Madonna performs her set, but she does not stick around for the end of the show, which turns into a group sing-along of We Are the World. Madonna leaves before that happens. You have to remember something about Madonna in 1985. This is July of 1985. Like a Virgin, I believe, was released in November of 1994, late November of 1994. So by the time Live Aid rolls around, Madonna is a global superstar. I mean, she wasn't Madonna yet, but Like a Virgin was a huge hit. It was a smash. Really kind of elevated, as most of you know, Madonna up in the level of the music world. So I think she probably had a right to be annoyed, pissed off, mad about not being asked to do We Are the World. Because remember, We Are the World was recorded in early 85, like late January of 85. So she was literally a Like a Virgin, early Madonna career version of herself. So yeah, she had a right to be annoyed. Madonna probably was the biggest person who played that American portion of Live Aid. I mean, I think the only person who comes close to rivaling Madonna, I'm only talking about American artists, by the way, would be Tina Turner. And remember, Tina Turner in 84, she'd had her comeback, Private Dancer, and she was a huge successful star at this resurgent part of her career. So Tina Turner was as big as they come. And even though Madonna was Madonna, I don't think she was Tina Turner in 1985. She was definitely bigger than Tina Turner by the end of 85. But by the time Live Aid rolled around, I think she was probably neck and neck with Tina Turner. Don't forget, Private Dancer was a huge hit. it's really interesting. You know, what could have been seen as a stunt, this would be Phil Collins playing both shows, Wembley and JFK in Philadelphia, via the Concorde, was talked about by the producers in the show, the CNN documentary, as the exact opposite. I mean, they thought it was, what did I write down? And a vital piece of theater. Now, Collins, they feel, essentially connected both shows, turning them into one event. So I thought that was interesting, actually. I remember Phil Collins doing Wembley and then flying over on the Concorde and then singing In the Air Tonight in Philadelphia and, you know, accompanying, who was it? Led Zeppelin, which we should talk about, by the way. Led Zeppelin performed after Phil Collins, and this was kind of a reunion for them as well. Jimmy Page and I guess, who is it? I'm not a huge rock music fan, aficionado, but I think it's Jimmy Page and Robert Plant. They had their issues as well. But apparently it was just a really rough performance. I don't remember this, but they say it was a very rough performance. CNN puts a little note on during the documentary saying Led Zeppelin refused to allow footage of their performance to be used for this documentary. And there are a couple of reasons that have been thrown about for why it was such a rough performance. According to legend, Robert Plant thought that they didn't have enough time to rehearse because they'd been off. And this is kind of a reunion for them. Jimmy Page has said in multiple arenas that Phil Collins is the reason the Led Zeppelin performance was so bad, because according to Jimmy Page, Phil didn't know the songs. So he's just back there playing drums and basically throwing everything off. Who knows what the truth is? Who knows where it lies? But apparently it was a very, very rough performance. Now, one of the things you notice about this documentary is the coverage of the performances in Wembley is very thorough. And I have to say, who knows? Maybe they're going to circle back to the coverages, to coverage of performances in Philadelphia for that leg of Live Aid, but it's pretty sparse by episode 3. And I think it's a couple things are very, very, very notable. Thing number one, the British artist who recorded Do They Know It's Christmas essentially appeared en masse for the Wembley Stadium leg of Live Aid. The vast majority of them there were there. Boy George and Culture Club wasn't there, but for the most part, everyone else was. YouTube, Sting, you know, Phil Collins, I think Spandau Ballet was there. Duran Duran, I think, played in Philadelphia, but so they participated. Do They Know It's Christmas Time artists were almost all there for Live Aid. What is striking is when you look at We Are the World. And again, I've told you that I think We Are the World is a better song, but it is the creme de la creme of American artists at the time. Not all of them, but a lot of them. And We Are the World artists are essentially a no-show for Live Aid. Very, very strange, very fascinating. I mean, you look at who's there. I mean, I think Hall & Oates played Live Aid. They had to play Live Aid. It's in Philadelphia. You know, I think they both went to Temple. So, of course, they're going to show up for that. But you look at who was not there from We Are the World at Live Aid. There's no Michael Jackson, no Bruce Springsteen, no Ray Charles, no Steve Perry, no James Ingram, on and on and on and on and on. I mean, it is amazing how little of the recording artists who made the record We Are the World actually show up in person to perform at Live Aid. Now, it's kind of unclear why that was the case, but there's a German music magazine called Eclipse. And in that magazine, Bruce Springsteen allegedly makes the statement that he didn't realize it was going to be such a big deal. And that's why he didn't show up. Apparently, Paul Simon and Huey Lewis couldn't stand or didn't want anything to do with Bill Graham, legendary music promoter, who was helping to promote the U.S. leg of Live Aid. Now, I don't have any proof of this, folks, so I'm saying this out loud before I make a statement. But I do think that Prince not showing up for the We Are the World record and the recording kind of infused the lack of participation in Live Aid proper. You know, you have this whole, to me, what felt like a, are you going to go? I don't know. Are you going to go? Kind of attitude among American artists for the Live Aid performance. And as a result, you don't get a ton of American heavyweights performing in Philadelphia at Live Aid. It's kind of a strange, eclectic, watered-down mix of performers. So that's the first thing that's notable. The second thing that's notable, and it's addressed in the documentary more than once, both in England and in the U.S., they talk about the notable lack of Black artists being asked to participate in Live Aid. And I have to say, you know, according to the research, this is one of the reasons Stevie Wonder chose to skip Live Aid. He said there's not enough Black artists there. You know, it's interesting. If you look at the Billboard Hot 100 from 1985, there are any number of Black American artists that could have played Live Aid in 1985. I'm going to read you a list of some of the artists who could have performed if they chose to, or if they chose to clear their calendars. Michael Jackson, Chaka Khan, Stevie Wonder, Whitney Houston, Luther Vandross, James Ingram, DeBarge, Ready for the World, Aretha Franklin, Cool in the Game, The Time, Sheila E., Rick James, James Brown. Look, it's striking how many of those artists could have been asked to perform at Live Aid that either weren't asked or didn't accept the invitation. And almost all those artists I read either had hits in the top 100 of 1985 or Billboard's top 100 hot hits of 1984. So they were all very relevant. Music was different back in 1985. I mean, it was a lot more segmented. Now, the industry, as well as listening audiences, just didn't cross over, quote unquote, as much. I'm not telling you that, like, Black guys never listened to rock music and white guys never listened to R&B, but there was a lot more segmentation. I mean, the classic example of this is when Prince first released his first three albums, Prince, For You, in 1999, the music industry press had a very difficult time trying to classify the type of music Prince does. Instead of saying it's just rock and roll, which it really was, it was rock. They were trying to find some other classification for Prince because he's a black artist. I mean, modern music in 2025 is so influenced by both hip hop and R&B that you don't even think about that today. I mean, an artist like Eminem is not considered anything other than a hip hop artist. You know, he might be considered pop music because he sells so many records, but he's a hip hop artist, and a legendary one at that. Back in 1985, hip hop and R&B was really just considered black music. So it's interesting how things have changed. And it is interesting to me that, you know, you don't have, how do you not have a group like, forget Prince, right? Whom I love. How do you not have a group like The Time, Morris Day and The Time, at the Philadelphia leg of Live Aid? I mean, they would have turned that thing out. It's very, very interesting. You know, Run DMC is the only hip-hop act that performed during Live Aid. And they performed in Philadelphia early. And if you watch the clip, you go on YouTube, you watch the clip of Run DMC, they're performing a great song, The King of Rock, one of their big hits, and it was new at the time. But if you look at that crowd in Philadelphia, the crowd, only about a third of the crowd is into Run DMC, who's killing it in their version of the song. If you're Run DMC, you got to be like, I got a stadium full of 100,000 people. You guys don't, you guys aren't into the song? It's very, very strange. Run DMC, by the way, one of the great band logos of all time. I mean, right up there with the Rolling Stone tongue or mouth, whatever it is, logo that they've used for decades. The Run DMC logo, awesome. So, music was different in 1985. And, you know, it was what it was. Live Aid, according to the documentary, raised about $40 million with both shows combined, which they say is the equivalent of $450 to $480 million, essentially in cash. Now, there is a fourth episode, at least, of this documentary. I was unaware of that. I thought they were going to wrap the whole thing up in three episodes. Apparently, there's a fourth episode. And this deals with Live 8, which I think was the 20th anniversary recreation of Live Aid, which occurred in 2005. So I'm kind of interested in that. I'm not as interested in that as much as Live Aid proper. I have a vague memory of Live Aid, but I will report back to you next week what I relearned watching this documentary. Anyway, so moving on. Folks, this end of summer series that we've put together for you, I think you are really going to enjoy tonight's segment on it. We're talking about an iconic sports theme music that is instantly recognizable. Now, I told you earlier that it has to do with football. Now, tonight's deep dive into this iconic sports music deals with this song. I'm going to sing it again to avoid copyright issues, but cue the music. Folks, of course, you know that as the theme to the NFL on Fox. What a piece of music, folks. Even more interesting is the story behind it. Let me tell you what it's about. In March of 1994, before I get too far into it, in March of 1994, Fox Sports was only a few months old, and it was being built on the fly after Rupert Murdoch had outbid CBS for the rights to the NFC conference and their broadcasting rights, right? Now, according to an article, it's a 2014 article in Deadspin, great magazine, David Hill was the president of Fox Sports, newly installed at the time. Again, it had just been created. He was in line for the Batman ride at a theme park. And he ends up calling an employee. This employee was named George Greenberg. Now, George Greenberg, who was he? George Greenberg was a 38-year-old new hire for Fox Sports. He was a former creative director of ABC Sports. So he's up there a little bit. Hill gave Greenberg an assignment. He said, I want you to find the theme song for Fox's NFL coverage. Now, Hill tells Greenberg, I'm in this long line for the Batman ride. I can't get this theme out of my head. Batman. Give me a superhero. Give me Batman plays football. Folks, this is how that theme song starts. So what does Greenberg do? George Greenberg calls a man named Scott Schrier. Now, Scott Schrier is a studio drummer who also wrote commercial jingles. Greenberg gave Schrier a couple days to come up with the music, right? Tight deadline. Now, Schrier, he was used to working on tight deadlines with no budget. He'd done commercials for Snickers, Miller Lite, Volkswagen, and Schrier, this is great, by the way, Schrier said that agencies would call him and they would say to him, hey, I just blew my budget on this music and the client hated it and it goes on the air tomorrow. Can you do anything for me tonight? I mean, this is how advertising and in some ways entertainment works. Sometimes you have very quick turnarounds, very tight deadlines. So Schrier was used to working. He almost felt like 2 to 3 days was a luxury to actually put this music together. So he takes the assignment. Schrier, he wrote with a couple other guys. He had a couple of writing partners. One was Canadian, the other was a concert cellist, and neither was a football fan. So according to Schrier, he said the three of them definitely wanted to put a real dark, manly, masculine football tint to it. Schrier described the theme music as being combative, written in a minor key, and having a warrior vibe to it, which you can kind of hear when you hear the theme music. Schrier himself, out of his own pocket, paid for the 48-piece orchestra with his own money to record the demo. He did it on spec. So Schrier recorded 3 tracks, all in the same key, all in the same tempo, all with the same palette, but structured differently melodically. Now, according to Schrier, the opening of any music is key. He said that coming from where he came from, the commercial jingle world, that he had to get his melody across in 30 seconds or less. He says, don't wait for the hook. Come out with the hook. Come out swinging, right? So this is what he did with his theme for NFL on Fox. Now, Schrier also, I'm not sure if you know this or not. I just found this out. He also wrote the theme music for Fox's Major League Baseball coverage. You know that song as well. I'm going to sing it just in case it's dead air. You'll know it's like 10 seconds, but I'm singing the Major League Baseball theme that Shrier wrote as well for Fox, which goes. That's Scott Shrier. He wrote that also, right? But he wrote the theme for Fox, NFL on Fox first. He likes to put the hook first so that it kind of like embeds itself into your brain. Now, Shrier sends the three tracks that he recorded. Again, this takes place over like 2 to 3 days. He sent the three tracks over to George Greenberg via courier, special courier, right? Now, this is 1994, so things aren't sent via email. Things are still hand-delivered to a large degree. Greenberg hears the tracks. He's blown away. David Hill, president of Fox Sports, picks Greenberg up from his Los Angeles hotel. Greenberg pops the CD into the sound system of David Hill's car. David Hill hears it. He says, "That's it. This is great." Now, Hill, president of Fox Sports, ends up meeting Shrier, and he listens to all three tracks with Shrier, and Hill says, "Give me the opening of track one and marry it to the body of track two." And that is why Shrier says it was so important to record all three tracks, even before he knew, in the same key, the same tempo, the same palette, et cetera, so that they could almost become interchangeable. So he ends up splicing the opening of the first track to the body of the second track. That is the story of the theme music for the NFL on Fox. Again, folks, I can't tell you, whenever I watch football, one of the true joys is hearing that theme music being played as they open onto the field of play before the game they're about to broadcast. It is awesome. It really gets me in the mood for football. To me, this is one of the underrated but iconic pieces of music associated with sports. And thank you, Scott Shrier, for creating it. I think it is awesome. All right. Moving on. Folks, we do have to talk about one Luka Doncic. Okay, so I know you saw the pictures. I saw the pictures too. I mean, Luka looks like literally a different person with all the weight loss that has occurred because of his off-season workouts. Wow. Boy, oh boy, oh boy. Luka Doncic. Now, I have to say, a couple things come to mind. Now, it is very hard to believe that you're looking at the same person. I mean, the pictures in the magazine are very, very stark. I mean, Luka, to me, is almost unrecognizable from how you have known him in the past to what those pictures are in Men's Health. But two questions come to mind. Number one, can he keep the weight off for the rest of his career? That's number one. Number two, if he can keep the weight off, how good could Luka be moving forward? Let's talk about the second part of the question first. I mean, Luka Doncic, logic dictates that he is going to be a better player now that he's more fit, now that he's in shape, so on and so forth. Is Luka Doncic the front runner for the MVP in 2026? I mean, this is kind of what you're talking about if you're looking at this logically. I mean, he is so transformed in those pictures in Men's Health that you wonder if he is just going to rip. This is a man who's already been up there in MVP voting for the past 3-4 years. I mean, now that he's in the kind of shape that it looks like from the pictures of Men's Health, he could rip the league apart. It's going to be fascinating to watch and see Luka with this new body and what he can do and what it allows him to do, because he is certainly way more fit in appearance than he was prior to this offseason. Now, I want to compare Luka to another all-time great who went through a weight loss, a notable weight loss himself, and that is one LeBron James. Folks, you remember, LeBron was never, in my opinion, pudgy in the same way that Luka was, but he was certainly heavy in the early part of his career. But if you remember, after he left Miami and rejoined Cleveland, LeBron was notably slimmer. I mean, notably slimmer. And you have to remember something. LeBron had won 4 MVPs before he lost the weight. So take that into account. Now, LeBron's weight loss, it occurred when he was going into his 12th season, and he was 30 years old at the time. Luka, with his transformation this past offseason, he is entering his 8th NBA season, and he is currently 26, or will be soon. Luka has a career average of 28.6 points a game, 8.2 assists, and 8.6 rebounds. Luka Doncic has never shot 50% or better from the field during his entire 7-year career. Now, just to give you a little perspective, LeBron shot 50% or better in 14 of his last 16 seasons, starting from the age of 25 to today. I mean, that's why LeBron, oh my gosh, how he's not an all-time great would baffle me by anybody's definition. Luka averages 35 minutes a game in 64 games a season. LeBron averages 38 minutes a game in 71 games a season. Folks, why am I comparing Luka Doncic to LeBron James? There is a very simple reason. After LeBron lost the weight, he never won an MVP again. Not to say he wasn't the greatest player in basketball during that time. Luka Doncic is already an all-star, an all-pro, you know, top 5 in MVP voting. If he's averaging 28.6 points a game in 35 minutes in 64 games a year, being pudgy like he was, what's he going to do when he's in shape? You know, Luka's never averaged over 30 points a game, I believe. 30 points, to me, is going to be Luka's floor. He could average 32, 33, 35 points a game, possibly, now that he's in shape. He should easily, and when I say easily, it depends on how he decides to play. He can't hang out shooting 3-pointers all day. But he should easily cross the threshold of 50% or more in a shooting position percentage. I mean, Luka could be an absolute crazy man now that he's lost his weight. I can't wait to see what's going to happen. You know, I'm a Knicks fan, but, you know, I'm rooting for Luka not only to play well, but to keep the weight off. Because who knows what his ceiling is? I don't think anyone knows what his ceiling is now that he is more fit. So that I thought was fascinating. I have to say, as difficult as the Western Conference is, to me, the Lakers have a legitimate chance to win the NBA championship. Now, again, they got to get through Oklahoma City. They got to get through Dallas. They got to get through Denver. They got to get through Houston. They got to get through Golden State. It's a slog. It's a war in the West. I get it. Agreed. But the Lakers, with Luka and a very motivated LeBron, in my opinion, have a chance to win it all, which would be crazy. And again, I'm really, really interested to see what Luka does moving forward. He has a chance to stamp his entire career if he goes about it the right way, which I have no reason to believe that he won't. Folks, the NBA has had a very, 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 very good offseason. Kudos to them. And I'm going to tell you something. I'm going to say something that I never, ever thought I would say in life, but I'm going to say it anyway. I'm a football first guy, and I've always been a football first guy, and I am still a football first guy. But thank God the football season is back and upon us, because it is going to give me something to watch week in, week out, with incredible interest until the NBA comes back. Folks, it's not like I'm not going to stop. It's not like I'm going to stop watching football when the NBA starts, but I am all in on the NBA this coming season. It is going to be awesome. I think they're going to have a monster 2026 season. You watch. I'm telling you, the NBA, where it's at. Of course, still football first. Guilty. All right, folks, we come to the part of the show where I get to ask you a question, and I think you know what that question is, but I'm going to ask it anyway. What are you drinking tonight? Well, folks, I can tell you what I'm drinking, and that is the A.D. Rattray Cask Collection Single Malt Scotch. Folks, I'm going to give you some information about this particular whiskey, and then I'll tell you what I think about it. A.D. Rattray Single Malt Scotch is distilled at Middle Duff in Speyside, right? All in Scotland. It's bottled by A.D. Rattray at Cask Strength. It's 13 years old. It is aged in a sherry butt cask. It is 61.6% ABV, which makes it 123.2 proof. It's non-chill filtered and natural in color. Folks, A.D. Rattray is apparently an independent bottler, and they buy these casks from different distilleries and either bottle and or blend these cask contents themselves and release it as product. Their cask collection is released four times a year, and there's usually 6 to 8 casks used in their collection. Now, this particular bottle that I am drinking from, the cask number was 900779. A little harder to find. And 653 bottles of this came out of that cask. What do I think of it? Well, I can tell you, it is almost a classic scotch. If you're into scotch, I think you're really going to enjoy this. It's mellowly aged. It's not burny at all because of the age. It tastes like scotch without hitting you over the head with the peat. It's very well balanced. It's very well done. I have to tell you, I got this bottle. I think it was for sale. I think it was $94. I got it for less than that because I had some points that I had accumulated. So I got this for probably like $25, which is not realistic. It's not a real number. But I think this is like $94. A.D. Rattray. Cask Collection. Single Malt Scotch. Is the entry for What Are You Drinking Tonight? Is it worth adding to your bar? I think if you like scotch, it is. And I think $94 is not too much to pay for this product. Now, if they ask you 100, 110, 120, pass. There are other options out there. But for $94, A.D. Rattray Cask Collection is completely worth it. All right, folks, that is the show for tonight. I want to thank you for watching. I want to thank you for listening. As always, we are here for you. Don't forget to tell your friends to like, to subscribe, do all the things that you would do to support any show or endeavor. We are here for you, and we will continue to be as far as the eye can see. So, with that, thank you for watching the show. My name is Cyrus Farmer. This is the Stomp the Tea podcast. And as always, we will see you on the first tee. Football's back.